Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So I decided I would just continue where I was asked in St. Louis to summarize some sections of the sixth canto, Prescribed Duties for Mankind. So I'll just continue where I left off. And where that is, wait till the commotion settles down a little bit. It's in relation to the story of Vritrasura. But before I go into the story of Vritrasura, are we all right over there? Kinda? Good. No? What to do? Oh, well. maybe it won't give the background, because you have to pay attention to get the background. The story is easy to listen to. You can half pay attention and still get the story. You don't want the story? What are you on? You want to go home? You want to go home? You're the center of attention.
I feel cold.
What to do? Take him home. Okay. I'll try again. Little background. If you recall from, was it just the evening before last, right? Thursday evening? Thursday evening? Kechit Kevalaya Bhaktya Vasudeva Parayana, that verse, the essence of the entire sixth canto. So the a major question in all of life, and even more specifically in all of theology, is what is our duty? Here we have this human form of life. What are we supposed to do with it? What is the duty of one who receives the human form according to the teachings of the Bhagavatam? Durlabham manasa janma. The human form of life is very rarely achieved. We discussed that on Thursday. And when you get it, you should use it properly, and if you don't use it properly, there are consequences. And if you use it properly, there's favorable consequences. There's ideas of duties that largely, if one has a sense of duty from a religious perspective, the goal of that duty is elevation. Elevation in punya, and with that punya, elevation in enjoyment in this life and the next life, even improved enjoyment in the heavenly realm. That's the wish of those who are situated in karmakanda. Those that can see beyond, it's this very interesting, someone that's unregulated becomes regulated by religious duty, and they start thinking about prosperity in this life, and then they start thinking about prosperity in the next life, and then they start thinking, well, gee whiz, if there's prosperity in the next life, that means there's life after this life. So that means there's a soul that lives after this life. So aside from the coverings of the soul and the prosperity of the coverings of the soul, what about the soul, the well-being of the soul itself? And that leads into Gyanakanda. Putting aside looking for prosperity and looking for who am I? What is the soul and the real interest of the soul? Gyanakanda. And as one advances further in Gyanakanda, what does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita about that? Bahunam janmanam ante gyanavan mam prapadyate Vasudev sarvamiti, because Krishna is the source of all souls. Not only I'm a soul, but so many souls, and Krishna is the source of all souls and everything that the souls require and the bodies require and minds require, and he's the source of everything. Vasudev sarvamiti. And that's rare. Samahatma sadurlabha. Very rare. So the human form of life is rare, and amongst the human form of life, those that surrender to the Supreme, that's very rare. But that's the duty. That's the third of the options. Gyanakanda, Karmakanda, and surrender fully to the personality of Godhead. Just as Krishna concludes in Bhagavad Gita. What is that? Sarva dharmam parityaja mamekam sharanam braja aham tvam sarva papebhyo moksha yishyami ma suchaha. So that's the conclusion of Bhagavad Gita. And the Srimad Bhagavatam begins where the Bhagavad Gita ends. It explains how to perform all of those nice duties of surrendering unto Krishna. See you later.
Bye, Emma.
He's a lively one, huh? Let's play. Okay, we now have another pair of lively ones. Just kidding. Okay. They need some lessons in prescribed duties. Okay, so the process of taking full shelter of the personality of Godhead is that kechit kevalaya bhaktya vasudeva prayana. That's the essence of prescribed duties for mankind. And to support that message, Shukadeva Goswami tells the whole story of Ajamila, who even unintentionally performed devotional service. And by that unintentional devotional service, he became freed from sarva papebhyo, all of his sinful reactions. Aham tvam sarva papebhyo. And he wasn't deliberately surrendering to Krishna. It was calling his name, or calling the name of Narayana. And by calling the name of Narayana, he was released. He was released from the Yamadutas, and he then left his home, that place where he was staying. He went to Badrinath. He lived in a Vishnu temple until the day he died, and when the day he died came, the Vishnu Vimana, Vishnu Dutas came and took him back to Godhead. Big difference where he was headed one time and where he was headed the other time. So following that, there's a number of narrations that are, I use the expression Thursday, compare and contrast. It's a teaching for those that know about how you teach. There are different options of how to convey a message, and one of them is compare and contrast. So that's what's happening in the section we're going to cover. There's the comparison between one who has not only done lots of pious activities and attained to attain a heavenly planet, the king of heaven himself, Indra. He's fascinated by pious activities, the rituals that increase pious activities, and he becomes very, very opulent, but he doesn't become pure, because that was the discussion very early in this sixth canto, first chapter. Shukadev Goswami is suggesting that the prescribed duty, if there's some mistake, you can do atonement, prayaschitta. But Maharaj Pariksit says atonement isn't enough, because you can make a mistake or commit some bad activity, perform some atonement, but still have the propensity to do the bad activity, and then do the bad activity again, and some atonement, and then it's neutralized, and then again the bad activity, because propensity isn't taken away. Like something that's in your garden that you don't want, like weeds. You want something, you want some nice vegetables or flowers or something that you want, and along with the something you want is something you don't want, weeds. So what do? You can just clip the top of the weeds and clip the top of the weeds and clip the top of the weeds, but their root structure is taking all the water. So you have to pull them from the root. So as with gardening, so with spiritual gardening, the message of the Bhagavatam is the tendency for sinful activity has to be uprooted. Like the discussion this afternoon, ignorance, ignoring the tendency to ignore Krishna has to be uprooted. And that's corrected by paying attention to Krishna, turning one's attention again to Krishna, in devotion to Krishna, becoming attached to Krishna, becoming a lover of Krishna. At least the regulative activities of bringing one's attention to Krishna. So, beginning with chanting. There's a whole discussion about the merit, the power of chanting. So Indra, back to the... This is... We're in chapter 12 and 13 of the sixth canto, summarizing. Indra, living in Indraloka, had a nice idea. Let's have a big festival in honor of myself. A big Indra Puja, Yajna. Everyone can come and gather and honor me. So that's what happened. Big festival. And right in the midst of the big festival, all the demigods and kinnaras and gandharvas, and they were all there, singers and dancers and glorifying Indra. And into the midst of the assembly came Brihaspati. And Indra wasn't paying any attention to anything but Indra. So Brihaspati saw he was so full of himself, he just turned and walked out of the assembly and left. He not just left the assembly, he left the heavenly planets. And Indra had another uh-oh experience. So they went searching everywhere, couldn't find him. Word got to the demons, the daityas. Brihaspati left. Their power is gone. Grab your weapons, let's go, guys. And they had a big battle and defeated the demigods. The demigods lost their kingdom. So Indra, along with many of the demigods, went to Lord Brahma and explained their predicament. Lord Brahma didn't have a lot of sympathy. He said, you do these things, Indra. What do you expect? It's foolish. When are you going to learn? So, here's a recommendation for you. There is one very qualified Brahmin who, in the absence of Brihaspati, can at least guide you and perform, be your Purohit. He can perform the rituals that can create auspiciousness once again, and you can regain your kingdom. So they went to his name was Vishvarup. Vishvarup was the son of Trashta. The long description goes earlier in the Bhagavatam, in this sixth canto. Trashta was in the line of sons of can't recall. He was an elevated line of, and a qualified brahmana, some elevated lineage and a qualified brahmana. But Twashta had married one of the daughters of Diti, in the line of Diti. I think he was in the line of the sun god, Twashta. And he married a wife, a woman, who was in the line of Diti. So he was had an alliance with the Daityas. And Vishwarup was his son. So he trained Vishwarup. Vishwarup, many things happened, but Vishwarup gave instructions to Indra how he could regain his kingdom. He gave him mantras that could create a mantra shield that he could be invincible to the weapons of the Daityas. And so they went to battle and they defeated the Daityas. So he was very happy. He got his kingdom back. This is one of the things that's very prominent in this section. Those that are attached to piety and the fruits of piety have this Ferris wheel program, or the sine curve, or the up and down. When things are going very nicely, he gets his kingdom back, he's very happy. When he loses his kingdom, he gets very unhappy. He does something to get his kingdom back, he becomes very happy. Something happens, he loses the kingdom, he goes back down again. And it's like that for those that are attached to karmakanda and the fruits of karmakanda, the fruits of piety. And it's endless. There's no stopping of that program. So that's one of the characteristics of pious activities. However one may accumulate pious activities, at some point the results of them are exhausted and one goes back down. Chinye punya marcha lokam vishanti, in the language of Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says after attaining the heavenly planets and living for 10,000 celestial years in great opulence, one's pious merit is exhausted and one again falls back down. It's unavoidable. It's just the nature of karmakanda option. So he gets the kingdom back and he's enjoying like anything. Then he realizes that Vishwarup is really expert. Vishwarup is... He never cried. Vishwarup was very expert in karmakanda rituals. So one of the rituals that he knew was how to create somarasa. So in the Vedic yagya, he created somarasa and distributed it to Indra and the demigods. But on the side, because Indra didn't know it, some of the mantras he chanted, because, you know, Brahmins that chant mantras really fast, who can follow what they're saying anyways? So some of the mantras he chanted were some of the somarasa was then for his relatives on his mother's side, the daityas. And this went on for some time until Indra got word. He's giving some of the somarasa to the daityas. So he got really upset. He didn't tell Vishrup, go ahead and do it. So this is what he did. He came to the yagya and cut off his head with a sword. In fact, he had three heads. One for chanting mantra, one for eating food, one for speaking. The father of Vishwarup then took retaliation, and with a Vedic yagya he created Vritrasura. Doesn't look like a friendly personality. Arose directly from the fire. Just like there's other examples of that. Drupad performed a big yagya in which Drishtadyumna and Draupadi came from the fire. Very similar. So their yagyas, through mantra, one can create beings. Only there was a little mistake. This is another nature of Karmakanda yagyas. He pronounced one syllable incorrectly. Tvashta was expert, but he still made a mistake. And instead of saying Indra Chatroho, he said Indra Chatro, which meant that he was creating a fiery demon that would destroy Indra. That's what he wanted, but he created a fiery demon that would be destroyed by Indra. And that's the nature of Karmakanda rituals. If you don't get everything exactly right, you don't get the result, or you may get the wrong result. So think of something that people want rituals for. They want a long life or prosperity or a nice husband for their daughter, and they say one syllable wrong. You get the opposite. Etc. So the process of bhakti is not like that. If you don't pronounce the mantra properly, you don't get the opposite result. But Karmakanda ritual, it has to be exact, precise. So Vritrasura, with his huge trident, started going on the warpath and defeated the demigods. So the demigods, then they were unhappy because they had their kingdom, but now they lost their kingdom. So this time they went to Lord Vishnu. And Vishnu, like Lord Brahma, admonished Indra, "You've done it again. Indra, what are you going to learn? This tendency doesn't go away by your Karmakanda rituals. It still keeps coming and keeps coming and keeps coming. But anyway, you're my devotee, and so I'll make a suggestion. I want you to get the association of a very qualified personality. And that qualified personality is pictured here, a sage. And I can't remember his name. What's his name? Dadichi, yes. Thank you. Go ask Dadichi for his bones. And if he gives you his bones, then you can take his bones and you go to Vishvakarma, and Vishvakarma will make a celestial thunderbolt weapon, which will be the means of destroying Vritrasura. So he went to Dadichi. And Dadichi, very liberal. There's many things that happened with Dadichi. He previously instructed transcendental knowledge to the Ashvini Kumaras. Even when Indra cautioned him, "Don't do that or I'll cut your head off." But the Ashvini Kumaras went to Dadichi and said, "Don't worry. We're expert. We know how, if he cuts off your head, we'll give you another head. In fact, you can speak to us through a goat's head. No, excuse me, a horse's head. We'll cut off your head, give you a horse's head. You can speak to us through the horse's head. And then when Indra comes and cuts off your head, we'll put back the other head on. He said, fine, let's do that. There's a nice picture, I don't have it here. Because the reason, Indra is protective, proprietary, a little jealous, because he has privileges that others than the demigods don't have. Even the Ashvini Kumaras were royal physicians for the demigods. They weren't demigods. So he didn't want them to have transcendental knowledge. But they wanted transcendental knowledge. And they were expert. So that's what happened. So Didici, was known as being very liberal. So Didici, just to play a game with Indra, he said, Indra, what are you asking? Don't you know that the body is the most dear thing to everybody? And you're asking for my body, the most dear thing to me? Please consider. Indra was very clever and very expert. He said, my dear Didici, you're a great sage. And even ordinary people, what to speak of great sages, their purpose of life is to serve others, using their body, mind, and words to serve others. And what greater accomplishment can one think of than having the opportunity to use one's body in the service of the demigods to regain the kingdom of the demigods? Oh, Didici, please give us your bones. And Didici said, I was just playing with you to see what you would do. Certainly you can have my bones. So he went into a trance of meditation and left his body and went to the spiritual world. And they took his bones, went to Vishvakarma, and gave Vishvakarma the bones. And Vishvakarma made an Indra thunderbolt weapon, very special, blessed by Lord Vishnu. And then they went to war. And they defeated the demons. Now Indra's happy again. But once the demons were defeated, there's a whole description of that defeat. They started running from the battlefield. And as they were running from the battlefield, the demigods, Vritrasura, their commander-in-chief, general, admonished them. Said, what kind of kshatriyas are you? You don't run from the battlefield because the other side is very strong. You continue your fighting. Your head's in the way. Just sit over this way a little bit. Thank you. And then when the demigods started firing at the backside of the retreating soldiers, he let them have it. You're demigods? And you're doing battle this way, shooting at the backside of soldiers that are retreating from the field? This is not Kshatriya spirit. This is not a religious person's conduct. What are you doing? A huge battle ensuing between the two. And Vritrasura, you see how big his feet are and how small the... Look at the elephants that are down by his feet. Just by walking, heading towards Indra... He's squashing so many people, holding his trident in the air. And Indra took you see in the left hand of Vritrasura, he's grabbing a hold of the club of Indra. Just grabbed it between two little fingers and took the club and smashed the head of Airavata. You see the blood coming out of Airavata's mouth. And Airavata fell back 100 yards and fell onto the ground. And Indra reached his hand in his mouth and revived him by some mystic ability and got back on the back of Airavata. And there's Airavata and Vritrasura looking at each other, eye to eye. And I want to read to you what Vritrasura says. Yes. Sri Vritrasura said, He who has killed the Brahmana, He who has killed his spiritual master, indeed who has killed my brother, is now, by good fortune, standing before me face to face as my enemy. Oh, most abominable one, when I pierce your stone-like heart with my trident, I shall be freed from my debt to my brother. Chivalrous talk. Only for the sake of living in the heavenly planets, you killed my elder brother. A self-realized, sinless, qualified Brahmin who has been appointed your chief priest. He was your spiritual master. But although you entrusted him with the performance of your sacrifice, you later mercifully severed his heads from his body the way one butchers an animal. Indra, you are bereft of all shame, mercy, glory, and good fortune. Deprived of these good qualities by the reactions of your fruitive activities, you are to be condemned, even by the man-eaters. I shall now pierce your body with my trident, and after you die with great pain, even fire will not touch you. Only the vultures will eat your body. You are naturally cruel. If the other demigods, unaware of my prowess, follow you by attacking me with raised weapons, I shall sever their heads with this sharp trident. With those heads, I shall perform a sacrifice to Bhairava and the other leaders of the ghosts, along with their hordes. So there's the chivalrous talk. But then the mood changes. But, Indra, if in this battle you cut off my head with your thunderbolt and kill my soldiers, O Indra, O great hero, I shall take great pleasure in offering my body to other living entities, such as jackals and vultures. I shall thus be relieved of my obligations to the reactions of my karma, and my fortune will be to receive the dust from the lotus feet of great devotees like Narada Muni. So these are words coming from that fellow over there, Dhritarasra. He's going to now go further into the mood of an elevated personality, an elevated Vaishnava. O king of the demigods, since I, your enemy, am standing before you, why don't you hurl your thunderbolt at me? Although your attack upon me with your club was certainly useless, like a request of money from a miser, the thunderbolt you carry will not be useless. You need have no doubt about this, because the thunderbolt weapon, which is in his other hand, was the plan of Lord Vishnu to destroy Dhritarasra. And Dhritarasra knows it, and he's reminding him, Indra, that thunderbolt in your hand, it's blasted by Lord Vishnu. Right over here, just apply it right over here and cut my head off, and I'll be relieved of this body, and with that, I'll be relieved of all the karma that has brought me to this situation, and I'll go to the spiritual world, and you'll get what you want. You'll get your kingdom back. You get what you want, I get what I want. Indra, don't dilly-dally. Be a hero. Oh, Indra, king of heaven, the thunderbolt you carry to kill me has been empowered by the prowess of Lord Vishnu and the strength of the Diji's austerities. Since you have come here to kill me in accordance with Lord Vishnu's order, there is no doubt that I shall be killed by the release of your thunderbolt. Lord Vishnu has sided with you. Therefore, your victory, opulence, and all good qualities are assured. By the force of your thunderbolt, I shall be freed of material bondage, and I shall give up this body and this world of material desires. Fixing my mind upon the lotus feet of Sankarshan, I shall attain the destination of a great soul such as Narada Muni, just as Lord Sankarshan has said. It goes on, talking to Indra for some time about the merit of, he said, our Lord, you have the same master I have, Lord Vishnu. And Lord Vishnu has given you the weapon. He's told you what to do with it. Do it. My master is also Lord Vishnu. I want to be with him. I don't want to be here in this material world. Then he starts speaking to Vishnu. He just forgets about Indra. He gets so absorbed in the Supreme Lord. Oh, our Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, forbids his devotees to endeavor uselessly for religion, economic development, and sense gratification. Meanwhile, that's karma kanda. Dharma, artha, kama. That's the karma kanda formula. O Indra, one can thus infer how kind the Lord is. Such mercy is obtainable only by unalloyed devotees, not by persons who aspire for material gains. O my Lord, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, when will I again be able to be a servant of your eternal servants who find shelter only in your lotus feet? O Lord of my life, may I again become their servant so that my mind may always think of your transcendental attributes, my words always glorify those attributes, and my body always engage in the loving service of your lordship. No, he's speaking the words of an very elevated, perfected soul. And it goes on like that. Just, please take me. Bring me to you. O lotus-eyed Lord, as baby birds that have not yet developed their wings always look to their mother to return and feed them. As small calves tied with ropes await anxiously the time of milking, when they will be allowed to drink the milk of their mothers, or as a morose wife whose husband is away from home always longs for him to return and satisfy her in all respects, I always yearn for the opportunity to render direct service unto you. O Lord, my Master, I am wandering throughout this material world as a result of my fruitive activities. Therefore, I simply seek friendship in the association of your pious and enlightened devotees. He goes on. I'm ready to go back to Godhead. And Indra is, as we say in the vernacular, he's blown away. He doesn't know what to do. It's not a demon. This is a perfected being. So he's stunned. He can't move. So Vritrasura decides to get him off the mental platform. He throws his trident at him. And immediately Indra takes his thunderbolt weapon and zaps the trident, and the trident splinters into little pieces. And then the battle ensues, and back and forth, and eventually Vritrasura opens his mouth and swallows Indra. And the soldiers see Indra entering the mouth of Vritrasura, and they get very unhappy. Oh, we lost Indra. But then they become happy again. Indra comes plowing out of the body, the belly of Vritrasura, and takes his trident and cuts off one of the arms of Vritrasura, and some other chivalrous talk back and forth between the two, and he cuts the other arm off. And it took 1 year to cut the head of Vritrasura's huge body sprawling on the ground. But afterwards, Indra, victorious in the battle, is now in big anxiety because he's realized he's killed the great personality. And he speaks some words: in the course of my desire to get my kingdom of heaven back, I've killed the great personality. The great personality is happy. Now he's back in the spiritual world. But here's Indra in the material world having to deal with the fact that in the course of his ambitious life, he's done some wrong things, a very, very wrong thing, and so sin personified comes pursuing him. And sin personified chases him. He runs. Indra goes in all different directions. He goes in the air. He goes in the land. He goes in the water. He goes in caves. He tries to hide. And sin personified is following him, looking like leprosy, bleeding. Indra finally, he decides by mystic power to take shelter in the stem of a lotus flower. He assumes a very small form. And for some number of years, Indra, the king of heaven, is hiding in the stem of a lotus, undergoing austerities in that position. And finally he comes out of that seclusion and returns to his position of the king of heaven. So, hearing all of this, Maharaj Parikshit is hearing this from Shukadeva Goswami. He asks the question, what just happened? This great personality, this great personality, it's so rare to find a person so qualified as this individual. How did it happen? O learned Brahmana, demons are generally sinful, being obsessed with the modes of passion and ignorance. How then could Vritrasura have attained such exalted love for the personality of Godhead? Demigods, situated in the mode of goodness, and great saints, cleansed of the dirt of material enjoyment, hardly ever render pure devotional service unto the lotus feet of Mukunda. In this material world, there are many living entities as atoms. Among these living entities, very few are human beings, and among them, few are interested in following religious principles. Out of the many persons who follow religious principles, only a few desire liberation from the material world. Among many thousands of those who desire liberation, one may actually achieve liberation, giving up material attachment. And many thousands of such liberated persons, one can understand the true meaning of liberation. That's very rare. And out of many millions who are liberated and perfect in knowledge of liberation, one may be a devotee of Lord Narayan or Krishna. Such devotees who are fully peaceful are extremely rare. My dear Lord, Shukadeva Goswami, although Vritrasura was a sinful demon, he showed the prowess of the most exalted Kshatriya and satisfied Lord Indra in battle. How could such a demon be a great devotee of Lord Krishna? These contradictions have caused me great doubt and have made me eager to hear about this from you. So how does somebody who is in such a circumstance of life become, how did it happen that he became elevated to this status? So here's another distinction between devotional service and fruitive activities, pious fruitive activities, karmakanda rituals, very, very expertly performed. One is, the latter is temporary, and the former is eternal. Like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, svalpam apyasya dharmasya trayate mahato bayat, that even a little progress, a little advancement, alpa, even a little devotional service that's rendered in this life is not lost. It's permanent. It's eternal. Like Prabhupada explains in simple language that we can all understand, if you make an investment, put some money in a bank account, you know, these worldly kind, and you die, what happens? It's gone. But the spiritual bank account, you put in 1%, and your next life it's 1%, or 2%, or 10%, or 50%, and your next life you continue where you left off, because it's permanent. It's a permanent asset. So, hey, anybody knows a little bit about finance? Something that can be lost or something that's permanent. Never lost. Not a difficult decision to make for banking or finance. So why is it difficult for spiritual life? And the answer is we're attached to material enjoyment. We're attached to the psychology, the mentality of being a worldly enjoyer. Even it means something temporary. But something that's permanent, not lost. This is one of the verses that I just read. O great sage, amongst many millions who are liberated and perfect in knowledge of liberation, one may be a devotee of Lord Narayan or Krishna. Such a devotee who is, such devotees are fully peaceful, are extremely rare. So where this is headed, this is chapter 14, here's chapter 17. Persons engaged in devotional service to Lord Vasudev Krishna have naturally perfect knowledge and detachment from this world. Therefore, such devotees are not interested in the so-called happiness and distress of this world. So, jnana vairagya viryanam nahi kashchit yapashrayaha. It's very similar, those that you know the first canto Bhagavatam, to another verse where Sutta Goswami is speaking. Savai pungsang paro dharmo yato bhaktir roksaje ahaitaki apratiyata ayatma suprasidati. In the translation, the supreme occupation for all humanity is that by which men can attain to loving devotional service unto the transcendent Lord. This is the dharma of mankind. Whatever other dharmas one may do, they're meant in the whole big picture of the Vedic system to come to the position of loving devotional service. Yato bhaktir adhoksaje. And when that devotional service is rendered in a way that's unmotivated and uninterrupted, one is completely satisfied. And until that position is reached, you're not completely satisfied. There's always something that's missing. So to respond, I'll just do this, just an introduction. To respond to Shukadeva Goswami, to Maharaj Pariksit's question, Shukadeva Goswami explains that in Vritrasura's previous life, before he became Vritrasura, he was a king. And the king's name was King Chitraketu. And one time King Chitraketu was visited by Angira Muni. And because King Chitraketu was a very pious and elevated personality, he received Angira Muni very, very nicely. He washed his feet and fed him sumptuously and offered kind words. And as you see, literally, he sat at his feet and requested Angira Muni for instruction. It was an open-ended question. When Angira Muni looked at the king and said, "Is everything all right? Is your treasury in your kingdom abundant? Are the citizens obedient to your order? Are all the rains coming in sufficient supply, and there's sufficient grains produced in your land for the necessities of all your citizens? Is everything going well in your kingdom? You don't look so good. What's missing?" And King Chitraketu blurted it out. He said, "How did you know?" "Everything is fine, except I don't have a son." It is the duty of a king to produce an heir to the throne. And so my initial queen, Krita Dyuti was her name, she was unable to bear a son. So I married a co-wife, And with that co-wife, there were no children. So a third wife, and a fourth wife, and 10 wives, 100 wives, 1,000 wives, 1,000,000 wives, 10 million wives. That's what he says. He beat Krishna. 16,000 wives. And Chitraketu had 10 million wives. And there's still no son. Now, one would think you'd get the message. It's not meant to be King Chitraketu. Just so cool it, you know. It's just... Just relax. Let go of that desire. It's not meant to be fulfilled. But he was unable to let go of that desire. So he was requesting Angira Muni, you're a very qualified mystic. Can you do some yajna that can enable me to have a child? So Angira was very astute. He understood that imparting transcendental knowledge to Angira wouldn't work because he wouldn't be able to hear it. So instead, he decided another approach. The other approach, he said, okay, very well. I will conduct a yajna by which you will have a son, but the son will be both the cause of great jubilation and great suffering. So Angira considered, supposing my son is not obedient, and that causes me grief, that's better than not having any son at all. So let's have the yajna. So Angira performed the yajna, and Kritadyuti was given the fruit of that yajna, whereby she was then able to conceive a child. And lo and behold, after some time, Kritajyuti became pregnant, and Angira was very happy. And Kritajyuti was very happy, and all the citizens of the whole kingdom were now very happy because that one missing element is now fulfilled. Everything is very nice. Everyone was happy except for the 9,999,999 co-wives who didn't have a son. And now Kritajyuti's getting all the attention from the king, and the son was born, and after some time everyone forgot about the other queens, and everyone was absorbed in this newborn son. In fact, Angira gave him a name before he was even conceived. His name was Harshashoka. Happiness, distress. So that's what they called him, Harshashoka. And the center of attention, little Harshashoka, was capturing everybody's attention, including the co-wives. So they became envious of Kritajyuti. And some of them got together and conspired. You won't believe it, but they conspired to kill the child out of envy. Because when one becomes envious, then any awful thing can be done, potentially. And that's what they did. In the middle of the night, they snuck in to the bedchamber of Kritajyuti's child, Harshashoka, and poisoned him. And so when Kritajyuti came in the morning, so there they shows they're giving him poison. Someone looking out to make sure no one's watching. When Kritajyuti came in the morning to greet the child, his eyes were closed. So she thought maybe he's still asleep. So she, whatever she did, sang a lullaby or something, and he didn't waken. And she then felt his body and realized that he was gone. Body was cold and stiff, and she screamed and collapsed on the ground. the king, Chichiketu, heard the screaming, and he thought the worst might have happened, and he came running and falling over his cloth and hitting the ground and getting up again and running. And when he saw the child lying in his bed in a dead condition, he lamented like a pitiable personality. When King Chichiketu, overcome by lamentation, lay like a dead body on the side of the dead body of his son, the two great sages, Narada and Angira, just happened to come. "Oh, King Chichiketu, you don't look so good. My son is gone." And with that, then some transcendental knowledge was imparted, first by Angira, and then when, because Angira, King Chichiketu was so out of it, he didn't even recognize Angira. He was so blurred with madness of anguish. But after hearing Angira Muni speak, he became revived. Then said, "Oh, I'm very sorry I didn't honor your presence. You're Angira Muni. You're the same one that made this arrangement for me to have a son." But the transcendental knowledge that was imparted, I'm just going to read a couple of the verses, and maybe we'll continue tomorrow. Here's Angira Muni speaking. It says that both Narada and Angira instructed him as follows. "O King, what relationship does the dead body for which you lament have with you? And what relationship do you have with him? You may say that you are now related as father and son, but do you think that this relationship existed before? Does it truly exist now? Will it continue in the future?" There's a nice little purport. "O King, as small particles of sand sometimes come together and are sometimes separated due to the force of the waves, the living entities who have accepted material bodies sometimes come together and sometimes are separated by the force of time." Clear? There's many such metaphors in the Bhagavatam. One comes in the next canto when, of all people, Hiranyakashipu is pacifying Diti and the relatives of his departed brother, Hiranyaksha. And he uses a similar metaphor. This one is that by the churning of the waves, seaweed is pulled from the bottom. And sometimes the same churning of the waves brings those seaweed clumps together, and they entangle themselves with one another. And the same churning of the waves pull the seaweed apart. Is there cause for lamentation when that happens? Then he gives another example. Sometimes in a village, there's a water tank, and the ladies from the village, they come together and gather the water at the water tank, and they have a conversation, and then after gathering their water, they disperse. Is there cause for lamentation when they're dispersed? A cause for celebration when they come together? Or here is, it's by the force of the waves of the ocean, particles of sand come together. "Oh, you're my brother. You're a nice particle of sand right next to me. You're my dear friend." And then the churning of the wave separates them. So like that, the movements of time are bringing people together and dispersing people. So with the previous one, you're thinking this is your son, but is he your son? What was he before, and what will he? Where is he going next? And it, right now, is he really your son? "O King, both you and us, your advisors, wives, and ministers, as well as everything moving and not moving throughout the entire cosmos at this time, are in a very temporary situation. Before our birth, this situation did not exist. And after our death, it will exist no longer. Therefore, our situation now is also temporary, although it is not false. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, the master and proprietor of everything, is certainly not interested in the temporary cosmic manifestation. Nonetheless, just as a boy at the beach creates something in which he is not interested, O Lord, the Lord, keeping everything under his control, causes creation, maintenance, and annihilation. He creates by engaging a father to beget a son. He maintains by engaging a government or king to see to the public's welfare. And he annihilates through the agents for killing, such as snakes. The agents for creation, maintenance, and annihilation have no independent potency. But because of the spell of the illusory energy, he thinks himself the creator, the maintainer, and the annihilator. We have different functions on behalf of the personality of Godhead. One of them is relevant to here, the function of a father. And now, because of that function, this is my son. But where does the capacity to be a father come from? Or where does the capacity to do anything come from? And if the capacity doesn't come from us, then are we the doer? Are we the cause of the result? Are we the intended enjoyer of the result? What is our relationship with our activities of this world? It's transcendental knowledge. If the capacity is coming from the Supreme Lord, then he is the proprietor. He's the enjoyer. He's the well-wishing friend. He's the one from whom everything is coming. And our attention should go to him instead of these misconceptions of the illusory relationships of things that we have or objects of this world and our relationship with them. So far, and continuing the rest of the discussion between these two sages, here's another picture, two sages speaking to the king and Kritajyoti. This is another one, Narada Muni and Angira Muni speaking transcendental knowledge. That's when they bring the sun back to life again. So, before speaking about devotional service, which is going to come later, there's these phases: Karmakanda, Jnanakanda, and then devotional service. So, transcendental knowledge has its value specifically in helping to bring reality into the picture and illusion out of the picture. Because King Chuchaketu, although a very elevated person, he was attached, so attached that he was blinded by the circumstance that he was in. It should be, for most persons, it's obvious. If something is not intended, then you don't keep pursuing it. And you can make an honest, diligent effort, but at some point it should be clear, it's not intended. It's not meant that I should have a son. But he was so intent on fulfilling, not just because it was the religious duty, it was his attachment. So when there's attachment, one can be blinded of transcendental reality. And when that attachment brings about grief, like we see here, then that opens the door for hearing transcendental knowledge. So sometimes, more than sometimes, often, people ask, why is there suffering in this world? And there's suffering in this world because we're attached. And like the question earlier today about misery. Misery is there because of ignorance. And there's the primordial ignorance of turning attention away from Krishna, but there's the series of subsequent ignorances that we engage in. Either that because we don't know, or because we just choose to not know. We actually know better and we're choosing otherwise. When real knowledge is within, we don't recognize that real knowledge that's within because we're attached to something else. And that something else, in principle, is being an independent enjoyer. And that disposition of being an independent enjoyer blocks transcendental knowledge. We can't hear it. We can't receive it. And a classic example of this is Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra, he received good counsel from so many people, starting with Vidura again and again and again, like that discussion that we had the other evening, Friday evening, about when Krishna came with his peace message into the royal assembly. So many personalities gave him very clear indication what he should do. Krishna spoke, Parashara Muni spoke, another sage spoke, Bhishma spoke, Dronacharya spoke, Vidura spoke. Previously, Akrura came from Dwaraka and spent a whole night explaining to Dhritarashtra what his situation was. He should give the kingdom to the rightful owners of the kingdom and abide by virtue and follow the laws of Manu and don't bring yourself and your whole dynasty some big trouble. Dhritarashtra heard the whole thing. In the end, he said, "What you say is true, but I can't do it because I'm attached." Each one of us has our fate. This must be my fate. I accept my fate, my destiny, whatever it may be. So there are different kinds of ignorance. That's one of them. But if we can't receive transcendental knowledge, if we hold on tightly to a mistaken conception of, in Dhritarashtra's case, wanting to be the king, or wanting to be, in a broader sense, wanting to be an enjoyer of matter. It's not our position. It's Krishna's prakriti, and he's the Purusha of his prakriti. We're also prakriti. We're para-prakriti, we're conscious energy of Krishna. But failing to recognize our position in relation to him, we become attached as enjoyers. And it brings misery and suffering. And that's to counteract the misery and suffering, to take up the cause. This is the message of the sixth canto that I'm repeating here. But to take up the cause of karmakanda, to neutralize the reactions that may bring us misery and to create further piety so we can enjoy, that's not what dharma is. Dharma for the purpose of artha, for the purpose of kama. Commonly, that's how people proceed and how they perceive. But the Bhagavatam's message is that's not the purpose. Those other dharmas are meant to prepare us or bring us to the stage of devotional service. That's the purpose. And that's what Angira and Narada are doing with King Chitraketu. So, just going back to why this story was told, eventually King Chitraketu becomes a perfected being. He hears the message of Narada, he takes it up, he becomes a perfected being. He goes to, in this present body, he becomes a resident of a heavenly planet. He's disinterested in heavenly enjoyment. He becomes so elevated, he's a dear associate of Lord Shiva, a friend, imagine, on that spiritual level. Parvati misunderstands something that King Chitraketu says, and she curses him to become a demon. And he accepts. This is the plan of the Lord, very well, so be it. He became Dhritarashtra. But the point here is, his consciousness of a perfected soul stayed with him. Even he got this unfortunate body, his consciousness was perfect, as we just heard. He spoke in chivalrous way as an enemy of Indra, but his desire was just to achieve the spiritual world and let the will of the Supreme Lord Vishnu prevail. If that will is that I should be destroyed by the weapon of Indra, let it happen. What are you waiting for? Here's my neck. Apply the weapon. Let the will of the Supreme Lord be fulfilled. It's radical. It's not ordinary. But that's the desire of a pure devotee. And the consciousness of a pure devotee is not created by the material circumstance. It doesn't matter in what body you're born. Not prevented by a certain body or created by a certain body. It's not based upon the body. Based upon the consciousness of the soul. That's what the Vritrasura story is narrating. And now this is how one can go from being a nice pious person who is attached to a perfected being. And it's instructions or association of sadhus like Angira and Narada. So to be continued tomorrow. Hare Krishna. Any discussion? Comments? Yes?
I want to understand the point that you said on the relationship in the generations. We are not related forever eternally except for our relationship with Krishna.
Yeah.
Then how do we understand the ceremonies which we do? Our forefathers, if we do this, they all be liberated. Or there is also a saying, if we take to Krishna consciousness and we do it, all our generations, all will be taken care of. So how do I understand that?
I don't know how you don't understand it.
No, because we are not related, because they are not my forefathers.
There's a karmic connection. It's not your eternal identity. But one of the things that he said is temporary, but not false. So there's a connection, but it's a temporary connection. So we take birth in the family that we take birth in, and we have as our children the children that come into our family, and etc. intergenerational, because there's some karmic connection. And if you become fully purified, the spiritual benefit automatically goes to them as well. You don't lose it, it goes to them as well because of that karmic connection. In those who are dear to you and you become a pure devotee, those persons become dear to the Supreme Lord. That's how it works. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's a description where the son-in-law of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, his name was Amoga, how he becomes delivered. He became delivered just because he was related to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya became delivered because he is the brother-in-law of Gopinathacharya. So Lord Chaitanya gave his mercy to him because Gopinathacharya and he were related. Those who are dear to a devotee become the object of affection of the Supreme Lord. So what happens when you become a well-wisher of everyone? Everyone receives benefit. But where are those souls that have actually the capacity to be well-wishers of everyone? You have to be like Prabhat, so connected with the Supreme Lord. That's your only wish. The well-being of the parts and parcels of the Supreme Lord. Otherwise, our attention goes to those who are dear to us, the smaller circle. Okay. Yes?
Guru Maharaj said, Chitta Ketu being cursed by Parvati, being at the elevator stair, he would have explained his intent, but he didn't do that.
He gave a brief explanation. He said that I've been misunderstood, but that's okay. The will of the Supreme is being manifest for you, and so I accept. He did explain himself.
So what I'm trying to understand is what Krishna is seeing is not the justification, it is just the humility.
I don't understand your question.
Like, he didn't try to justify his
That's correct.
Action, but he accepted it, whatever it is.
That's right.
So, that pleased Krishna definitely.
It's not that we're... Don't extrapolate. Don't take from this, oh, that anytime anything happens that I should just say Hari Bol. Is that what you're doing? In that particular case, that was what the Lord wanted, and that's what he did. Because he had another service for him, to become the Trasura. When you're on such a platform as Chinchitraketu, you'll know what to do. You're not. So don't imitate. But the lesson, because he was on that platform, the lesson is, for him, he saw equally any outcome. Heaven, hell, liberation. Apito yarta darshanam. That was the lesson. I saw your mind running over that way, so I captured it. Something else? Anyone? Yes?
You mentioned that the analogy of the spiritual account, does it ever get repeated?
No. It might get covered. It might get covered. And it gets covered by forgetfulness or ignorance. But it's not depleted. Yes?
Thinking of the how you were saying about having a material desire. But but it is in a sense of like, you know, it is going to help somebody. So addressing that, though it is a material thing, but still it is good for other person to
it's less clear to me than it is to you what you're trying to say.
Though I have
a desire to help someone. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, but it might be a material
thing. Okay, and then?
But still, like, no, it's a mix. I don't have a purity, but it's mixed thing. But still, when I'm trying to help other person, that it might not work because there is no purity. So, what should we do? Like, no, I have to withdraw, and I should not say anything, or still I have to encourage.
Where's her husband? Can you translate this one for me? Do you think you know what she's talking about? No, you don't. I don't either. here's what I think you're saying. Supposing you know, supposing somebody that comes to our Bhakti Vriksha group, there's a problem. I'm less than perfect. I see they have a problem. I want to do something to help. What should I do? Because it may not be effective because I'm not pure, I'm less than perfect. What should I do? Is that what you're... Something like that? Yeah? Well, according to your capacity, first order of business is to get out of the doership mode and into the humble service mode. Hit that reset button. Don't think I'm going to go help the other person with their problem. You can be in the mood of service, and as an instrument of Krishna, you can perhaps do something if Krishna so desires. Then another thing next is, what's the spiritual interest of this person's situation? So think, you may not be able to deliver that, but think, what is the spiritual interest of this person? Then you give the third is the circumstance. What's appropriate? What's within my capacity and what's appropriate in this mood of humble service and the ultimate destination for the individual? And according to your capacity, you can make some endeavor. If Krishna so desires, something. Insert in a mood of service. It may be the something that you do is you just pray. May be that you find someone who's a more qualified individual and see if they can help the person. Maybe just encourage them in their basics of Krishna consciousness. Maybe so many things. But, you know, first check the mood and get a spiritual conception of what's happening. And then you serve according to your capacity. Pretty close? Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, please accept my humble request. Thank you for that class, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
I had a question also, like what Prabhu was asking, like, you know, as you explain a comic action, like what is the relation, like father or forefather, sons? You mentioned like our responsibility, like devotees are it. And what about our sons, like grandsons, if they're not devotees, you know? Is it still, we need to take care of
the
responsibilities also if they're not following.
Well, if by one stroke all other things are accomplished. You become, that one stroke is, you become a pure devotee. If you become a pure devotee automatically, you don't need to do another thing, by that one thing you're benefiting those that are in relationship, in family relationship with you. You follow? So you don't have to worry about, you know, I have this duty and that generation and that way and that way. It's all taken care of just if you become pure in devotion. As Prabhupada said, if you have $1 million, you solved your $10, $100 problems. So get the $1 million. Or become a pure devotee. Become pure, more pure in devotion, and benefit will automatically go to others without extraneous effort. You may take up some effort, you may not take up some effort, depending upon the circumstance, but benefit will go to those individuals nonetheless.
So as individual, we need to do our duty first.
Your first duty is you become Krishna conscious, and then from that position, you can then select of the different unlimited options of what can be done, this might be most appropriate. And another one, that might be most appropriate. And another one, another thing. But you're thinking in terms of what suits the situation. Yatharham upayunjita, according to suitability, what's appropriate for the circumstance. And Krishna will prompt you, just like this statement King Chitraketu was on the platform of understanding what Krishna wants. And so that's what he did. Another circumstance might be another thing that's appropriate. So the first is come to that platform of Krishna consciousness, and then we'll have much better capacity to understand what's appropriate for each circumstance of life. Otherwise, we're covered. We have less clarity about what should be done for this relative or that relative or some circumstance of life. That all right?
Yes, ma'am.
But
can you a little bit elaborate karmic relation, like, you know, how we are related, like father or, you know, sons, like brothers, you know? Like, is it just because of I don't know, Maharaj, like I'm a little bit trying to understand how we are related. I mean, like, we are everybody related to Krishna, and we are part and parcel of Krishna.
Okay.
But because of our whatever foodie mentality, desire, we came back to material. But we are related, right? Like, for example, you are blood to some family. You have father, mother, and maybe forefather, I mean, whatever, brothers, sisters.
Yes.
Is it just, I mean, can you a little bit elaborate to understand how we are linked together? And
A very short answer is it's very complex. I'll just take my life for example. You know, why was I born in America? I'm very clear. I'm very from scripture and from other things. Previous life, I was engaged in devotional service. Why someone who was engaged in devotional service in a previous life took birth in America? One answer Prabhupada gave is my Guru Maharaj had a number of you take birth in America, the Western country, so you could assist me in my mission. Now, what's that? It's very complex. It's not just I did this and so I got that. Cause and effect. Karma. Now, there may be some, you know, other, this reason, that reason, a million other reasons of why a certain set of parents, mother and father, are karmana daivane trena, is the phrase that Prabhupada would regularly refer to from scripture. The daiva, superior authorities, make the decision who is one's next mother, father. And the factors that go into that are very complex. It's something back there. But, you know, what it is very complex. Something that gives me an opportunity, in a devotional sense, to go further on the path to Krishna. That's from a devotional perspective. From the good fortune, ill fortune perspective, it's very complex. Good fortune, ill fortune, who can say? Something that looks unfortunate may be fortunate, depending on how we take it up. There are forces of the principal ones that Krishna speaks of are guna and karma. One's past association with the modes of nature, one's past involvement in fruitive activities. Those two combined, along with the force of time, they bring the soul to a position that matches what the soul deserves and needs. But just you, in that one sentence, there's four of the five factors of eternal truth. Guna, karma, jiva, kala, and Ishvara. Those are the five factors that are five subject matters of Bhagavad Gita. With that, it concludes everything. So, Supreme Lord is the decider of those complicated factors of guna and karma. And time. Tick, 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 tick. It moves things along. And one dies, and the soul moves to another body. Prabhupada explains, just to amplify the complexity element, Prabhupada explains that a coma is a condition where the body is unfit for habitation, but the destination of that soul hasn't been determined yet. Why not? There's so many options out there, but it's, you know, the right one hasn't been determined yet. So, coma. It's like suspended animation. And sometimes the person comes back and continues their life in this body, and sometimes they go on to the next body. Because it's complex. When I was little, I used to do many things. One of the things I used to do was play golf. And I was fascinated by what's inside a golf ball. You ever see what's inside a golf ball? There's this white covering, that little pockmark thing, and you take the surface off, and inside it's a set of rubber bands that are just wound around and 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 around. That's karma. Where does it begin? Where does it end? It's too complex. And then you cut through all the rubber bands, and inside there's this little, another little something, you know, rubber something, hard rubber something, so that when you hit the golf ball, it's elastic. There's a hard solid, and then there's this rubber bands, you know, strands, and depending on how you hit it, and then round surface, and boom, there it goes. So karma is very complex. To unravel it and say, okay, here's this one, and then you lay it over that one, and then you lay it over that one. It's too complex. There's so many factors. And it's not just one lifetime's factors. It's many lifetime's factors. It's like, say, aside from a particular mother and father, just what species? That's Yamaraj's job. If someone hasn't performed their duty in life, they're given a hellish existence. And from that hellish existence, then a lower form of life existence. Which hell and which form of life? And so supposing somebody's in a little bug body, a spirit soul in a little bug body, and he just, you know, does what bugs do. They fly around and walk around and bite people and do stuff and get eaten and eat other bugs, and, you know, they just do bug things until that duration of life is exhausted. And what happens is some of the layers of karma are burned, and because the layers of karma are burned, it comes a little bit closer to the original consciousness of the soul. So consciousness elevates after the bug body, and then they get, you know, a lizard body or whatever it is. You know, the next species, and the next species, and the next species. And then, you know, particular, why this mother and papa lizard? It's very complex. But it's, you know, the principle is reduction of karma up to the point of, here we come to this human form of life. And now comes, okay, I have a particular mother and father, but... And there's duties involved with mother and with father, towards mother and towards father, but then there's a higher duty to God. And, you know, one, it's an opportunity. So the complexity of how all these other connections work is, that's how Prabhupada speaks of it. It's so complex. there's certainly the principle of cause and effect, but there's multiple causes. At every moment, at every second that passes, they're accruing karma and burning up previous karma. And it's, you know, who's going to keep track of it all? And it's not, again, not just this lifetime, but so many lifetimes. So, just to keep it really simple, at least as simple as possible, the particular family that we take birth in is due to our past karma and the circumstances of our life. In Queen Kunti's words, Janma, Aishvarya, Shruta, and Shri. These four, there's others, but these four principal ones are the fruits of our past activity. And if we remain attached to them, then that covers our consciousness. So it's nice to understand some of the principles involved, but to become too much involved in, well, you know, this thing happened, what's the karma that's behind this thing, and that thing, what's the karma behind that thing, and ay, ay, ay. Too complex. And it's not really going to solve the problem of being embodied. We look to where we're going and accept that behind us there's so many things, and ahead of us is our path to Krishna. And as I go towards my path to Krishna, that will be lessened, slackened, reduced, the impelling effect of it. It doesn't mean I then become disrespectful to others and callous and careless and I don't care, because I only care about Krishna, so I don't care about you, I don't care about you, and you're temporary, get out of here. Not like that. We carry out our duties in a theistic way and stay on our path to Krishna. And by so doing, those who are near to me and dear to me, I certainly care about them. And because I care about them, as they become elevated in Krishna consciousness or God consciousness, they're going to receive benefit. And I'm continuing to interact with them, but they're going to, through those interactions, they're receiving benefit. And even if I don't have interaction with them, there's previous generations this way and successive generations the other way. I may never meet them, but there's some connection, and temporary connection, no longer present connection, but some karmic connection, and however that all works out, benefit is going to that soul and those other souls. Like Daivane Trena, by divine arrangement. So I don't have to worry about accumulation of wealth and putting it in a will. I have to worry about developing proper Krishna consciousness. And I don't have to put that in a will. It gets passed on. By superior arrangement. Something else? Yeah.
How do we cultivate spiritual conception?
How do we cultivate spiritual conception?
In relation with devotees like here or like other.
In relation with devotees like peers and other devotees?
Yeah.
That's a broad question.
From the scriptures, it is clear that I'm representatives of Krishna. Like, that picture is clear, you know, the position of spiritual master, teachers, and everyone. In terms of relation with wife and family members, friends, or devotees. So how do I cultivate spiritual conception?
See them as spirit souls and serve them on that platform to your ability. There's a bunch of spirit souls. They're not guru and they're not teachers and they're not immediate family. At least most of them aren't. Some of them aren't. Serve them as spirit souls. Is that all right? try to see through the eye of Scripture. And through the eye of Scripture, through the lens of Scripture, see them accordingly. So read Bhagavad Gita, chant your rounds nicely, and through the lens of what you've heard, you try to see and try to act according to the lens of the Scripture. And as the heart becomes more purified, that's the lens that you'll just naturally see. You don't have to like consciously hold up the lens. Okay, I'm seeing them in a different way, but let's try to see them in a spiritual way, in a spiritual lens. It becomes part of your how you see the world through cultivation of the process of hearing and application. The material conception is replaced by the spiritual conception, by the process of hearing and chanting and applying. Okay. Yes?
Maharaj, if someone does that, something bad to me, I try not to think something ill towards that.
Good.
But I end up thinking that, you know, Yamaraj is watching everybody. And so if that person did something really wrong,
they're going to get it.
Right. And so
they'll get theirs.
I don't need to think anything ill towards them.
I don't have to worry about it. Yamaraj will take care of it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. But still, it's not like I forgive them or anything like that. It's still that, you know, Yamaraj will take care of it because they did do something wrong. And I just don't have to
get involved. Well, what you say is true. And I know what that thinking is like. And it's not wholesome. Because it's not vindictive, but it's not well-wishing either. So keep going, because you got beyond the vindictive, and now you're in the neutral. I don't have to worry about this. This is, you know, Yamaraj is going to let him have it. Go one step further. Wish them well. Because otherwise, you're not holding on to ill will explicitly, but implicitly you are. The fact is, if they do something that's wrong or bad or hurtful, what's behind that wrong or bad or hurtful action? You know, one should know. There's some pain, there's some suffering there. And because of that pain and that suffering, they're acting the way that they're acting. How unfortunate that they're experiencing that. And then in turn they're doing something that's making it worse. And what can a little jiva do about that circumstance? Because they're in that circumstance because of free will choices they made, and you know, try to tell them otherwise and they'll tell you, get out of here. Get lost. You're crazy. So you can't directly inform them. This is your circumstance. But you can wish them well. And as you become spiritually elevated, simply by your well-wishing, some good will come to that person. Instead of, you know, I'll just step back and let Yamaraj take care of them. Proactively wish them well. And that's a common, and it doesn't have to be just something that's done hurtful against you. There are people that are doing hurtful things against all kinds of people all over the place. Well, because it doesn't impact me, I don't have to worry about Yamaraj is going to get them. And I don't even entertain that thought because it's not in relation to me. But as one grows in God consciousness or spiritual consciousness or Krishna consciousness, one is concerned about that, the suffering of others. Well, it doesn't impact directly on my life, but it's impacting on theirs. And what can one do? So you can pray for them, and one of the things that's part of Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement is we engage in congregational chanting. Because even people may not be, they may be present, not present, it brings auspiciousness in this inauspicious atmosphere. So just sitting here in the room, or publicly going and performing Sankirtan, chanting, or publicly distributing knowledge in various ways, certainly by distributing books, or some form or fashion of giving light in a situation that where there's darkness. And that is not directly impacting on me anyway, but it's the benefit, that benefit, let that light be distributed. And let my, as much as time permits and my heart opens, let that come into this world. So some regular, one of the ways to help that happen, like go beyond the, you know, Yamaraj is going to take care of them mentality to wishing them well, forgiveness of their wrongdoing, and understanding the pain that's behind the wrongdoing and wishing that they would become relieved of that pain that's behind the wrongdoing. Well-wishing upon other living beings can be executed in a regulated way, just like chanting in a regulated way. Doing something, and I'm sure you've run into it in school already, and certainly in college you're going to run into it. It's called social activism. You know all about it, because I'm sure it's in school. So, let me do something to help others. Social activism. And here's a very nice thing that you can do because you have knowledge of Krishna consciousness. Those social activists, where the light is on a little bit and they want to help people, many of them, that I've interacted with at least, have come to the realization that that's not going to work. Because people are, their lifestyle is such that it's debilitating. It brings the suffering upon themselves, and even you try to change the system, their habits are such, their lifestyle is such, their desires are such, it's going to just change the channel but bring the same situation upon them. They have to change the consciousness, not just change the behavior or the systems. They have to change the consciousness. Many are realizing that. So you can interact with and be a voice to speak that message, and then some people are going to get it. A lot of people aren't. They just want to be busy being doers and, you know, philanthropists and social activists. Make a change, make the world a better place without change of consciousness. But there's some that will get it, and you can be a, give that message. Regularly figure out a way in your life that you can do that. Be a small conduit or conveyor, an instrument of that message. And amongst the persons that you'll be moving in circles with, some persons are going to want to hear it. And that'll make a permanent difference instead of a temporary difference in the quality of life. If in the course of your college days you can find one such person, it's like this example of one moon as opposed to so many shooting stars, if you can find one person that sincerely gets it and takes up devotional practices in their life sincerely, you'll have had a successful college life. One person. Many persons, great, but at least one person. See, you know, pray to Krishna for that opportunity to find one person and convey that message to, and they take it. And Krishna will send you. And practice like that, and then this other thing that you're speaking about, people that do something harsh or hurtful, you'll be their well-wisher. You'll come to that other level by practicing one thing. It'll permeate. Yes. The kids sound like they're having a great time. Go ahead.
I kind of answered my question actually in the class. How do we really overcome the weakness of heart?
How do we overcome?
Weakness of heart.
Weakness of heart. By a strong heart.
I mean, due to attachment, especially to family members.
By attachment to?
I mean, weakness of heart, attachments. Attachments, especially.
Say, can you? I'm getting little pieces, but not the whole picture. How do you overcome weakness of heart or attachment?
No, weakness of heart because of attachment.
Because of attachment, become attached to Krishna. How do we become attached to Krishna? By becoming attached to those who are dear to Krishna. How do you do that? By associating with them and serving them and hearing from them. Sadhu sangha. In Seattle, I really had a great time. During the past Thanksgiving holiday, I gave a whole seminar on Sadhu Sangastaka, eight verses by Lord Kapila Dev, explaining what that is. Ashtaka, eight prayers on Sadhu Sangha. And there's the answer. He specifically says, the very same attachment to the temporary, transfer it to sadhu. By so doing, the spiritual world opens up and all that unwanted thing, because that's what Devahuti is asking. How do I become free from family attachment? Because Kardamuni just left her husband for so many thousands of years in Satya Yuga. And there she is alone. She's used to being with Kardamuni and very happily serving him, and he's gone. And there's Kapila, her son, but she understands he's not going to be here permanently either. So what am I going to do about my attachment? Then his answer is transfer to sadhu. And then clarity comes. Transfer attachment doesn't mean all of a sudden or at some point in time, I just don't care about anybody. That's not what it means. You care, but not in the mood of attachment, in the mood of attachment to the eternal soul and to the soul's eternal relation with Krishna, that kind of attachment, through the medium of sadhu sangha. That's the solution from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Do you like it? Good. Yes.
Please accept my humble obeisances.
Hare Krishna.
And thank you for the class. Maharaj, one question, like the spiritual knowledge, how to make the application, like how do we help ourselves for applying it?
How do we help ourselves?
In applying it.
In applying it.
In our day-to-day lives, like starting from something as simple as my child is not well, I'm not feeling well, to something which is like bigger things in life, like loss of a near or dear one. So when that kind of moment comes, how do you get the strength, like you know it, but yet you are feeling sad about it, and so like the application part.
Each of us has to act from whatever our capacity is. So circumstances may reduce capacity, at least seemingly. And other circumstances may strengthen capacity. And so the capacity barometer may go up and down. So there's the temporal, the moment, and then there's the long term. The moment, according to capacity, you act. You know, like this, an earlier question. Or a question about, you know, I feel I should do something, but I'm not pure, so what should I do? In that circumstance. To your capacity, you act. So you have received some transcendental knowledge. With whatever capacity you can hold it, you act on it. And you find that if you act on it, something happens. That much which you have and you act on it, strength that wasn't there suddenly comes. You follow what I'm saying? According to your capacity, you act. Then, two other things. Long term, have a regular practice, whether you know the capacity is here or here or somewhere in between. According to your with regulation, engage in receiving and try your best to receive in a qualitative way. The qualitative way, by that it means with your heart open to the message and the persons, plural, who are delivering the message. With your heart open, you can receive best. That's one of the things that, we discussed this afternoon about receiving transcendental knowledge. When your heart is open to the broadcaster, you can have the receiver turned off, but you can have it turned on, and it can be wide open receptivity. But so regularly, as much as your capacity permits, regularly hear in receptive mood what's the message. And then, as part of the receiving responsibility, is you apply it. Just like the verse from Bhagavad Gita, Tadidhi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya. Submission, inquisitive question, inquisitive spirit, and service. Render service not only to the person, but part of the service to the person is apply the message. So practice regularly applying in your relationship with the person from whom you received that message. It strengthens the relationship. Yes? And then because the relationship has become strengthened, next time I go back to hear, I'm hearing with a stronger relationship. I'm with more eagerness, more attentiveness. So I practice, and long term, I practice. Abhyasa yoga yuktena chetasa nanyagamino. Abhyasa. A big part of well-being is spiritual well-being is practice. In the language of Rupa Goswami, anushilana. There's a verse from Nectar of Devotion or Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Anushilana means cultivation. And cultivation according to what I have received. So it's a relationship. I receive. And not only I say the words, thank you, but my life is an expression of gratitude. Thank you. It's a relationship. And it's a cultivation of a relationship. A cultivation of Krishna consciousness is a cultivation of a relationship in an ongoing way. So that's the third part. So the first is, according to your capacity, you do. Another is, have a sadhana where you're regularly hearing and hear with maximum receptivity. And the other is, just to put it in one word, anushilana. You cultivate that which you have heard. You apply it in your life with practice. And in fact, it's cultivating the relationship with the source from which you've heard. Ultimately, it's Krishna. And more immediately, it's some persons from whom you're hearing. You're cultivating that relationship so that when you go back to hear, it's enriched. Your receiver is stronger, or receptivity is stronger. And then you grow. Is that all right?
Yes, Maharaji. But, I'm kind of probably repeating my question. Like, the practice seems to be easier when circumstances are, like, less unfavorable as compared to when it's more unfavorable. So, what does that... I'm sure it is my weakness and my impurities that has to do with it. How to make that better?
You don't have control over the circumstances. Sometimes, if I understand your question correctly, sometimes circumstances are favorable and it's easier. Sometimes circumstances are more challenging and it's more difficult. So what to do? Because you don't have control of your circumstances. Somebody else does. Krishna. So he's throwing some difficult circumstance your way. What are you going to do? Krishna, I'm not going to cooperate with you. I'm going to give you those circumstances. You deal with the circumstance. It's an opportunity to serve. And then another one is another opportunity. And life is different opportunities to serve. And let the service not be determined by... Let the service mood not be determined by the circumstance. Oh, I'm happy. That's Indra. Oh, I've got my kingdom back. Oh, I lost my kingdom again. Oh, I got my kingdom back. Oh, I lost my kingdom again. And then happiness and distress. Ahoituki apratyata yayatma supersedati. That one of the verses that was showing on the screen there. Ahoituki, without hate, without material cause or circumstances. Circumstances don't create devotional service. Devotional service is from the soul. And circumstances can't check devotional service. Devotional service comes from the soul. It can't be checked or created by circumstances. So if you're finding too much, circumstances are giving me lots of enthusiasm. Oh, circumstances are, I don't have the same enthusiasm anymore. Then that means, it's an indicator to you that you're on the material platform more than wanted. And so continue in those challenging circumstances to your capacity to serve. Thanking Krishna for this wonderful opportunity to feel no other shelter but his shelter. Because the material circumstances are certainly not the shelter. Although previously I was thinking they were. That's why I was enthused. And now when they're taken away, I've lost my enthusiasm. It's a nice opportunity. Now that's easy to say. It's another thing to do. But we take the circumstances when they're challenging, and we do. And you get lots of realizations when that comes. One devotee recently wrote to me saying that he said it very eloquently, the defining moments of my spiritual life have come when there have been severe challenges. So we don't have to pray to Krishna for severe challenges. They'll come anyway. And it doesn't mean, oh, it's my bad karma. It may be just Krishna's making some opportunity for me to be more dependent upon him, exclusively dependent upon him. Yay! Fantastic! Easy to say. But that's the test of our Krishna consciousness. Because there will come a time when everything is taken away. Everything. Our breath. Everything. You know, doesn't matter how tightly we try to hold on to it. It'll be taken away. And then what? Oh, I'm discouraged. No. Krishna! Remember that one. Anything else? Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Yeah.